Hi there, Gemma here. If you're enjoying our podcast, then please do come along and put your name down on the wait list for our Schema Circle. And that way you'll hear when we next open the doors for new members to join. The Schema Circle is really our passion project, and it's our online schema coaching membership program. There's nothing really quite like it. It's new and innovative, and we just love it. Now, there's a huge library of content waiting for you already inside. We also continue to do 3 live Q&A coaching calls every month. Now, everything is recorded, of course, and ready for you to view at your own pace. If you're looking for, a unique way to understand yourself better and to make real change, then I do invite you to come and have a look. Go to theredflagproject.com.au/SC. Now, the Schema Circle isn't therapy, but it's a great accompaniment to your own therapy journey. It's also a great resource for therapists and coaches and for anybody, men and women, wanting to know more about schemas and how we can use this fantastic model to empower ourselves to make actual changes, the changes we want in our life. Now, it's currently housed on our Red Flag website, and just click the link below to read all about it. I hope to see you inside one day. Thanks for joining us at the Good Mood Clinic podcast, where we get to the heart of the matter about what makes us humans tick. We're Justine Corrie and Gemma Gladstone, 2 clinical psychologists and schema therapists, and we're passionate about helping you break unwanted life patterns and finding new ways to understand yourself and those tricky people around you. Life is way too short to be derailed by our schemas, by self-sabotage, toxic relationships, or a lack of self-worth. So let's tackle this together and help you reclaim your life and who you really are. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Good Mood Clinic podcast. My name's Gemma Gladstone, and I'm here with my colleague and co-host, Justine Corrie.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Jim.
Hi. And we're back again for another episode. This is number 54.
Wow, 54.
It's very exciting. It's getting up there. We thought we would talk about one of the really pretty, it's a pretty common schema, and it's a schema that develops pretty early in life. It's one of the core schemas. So yes. Today we're going to talk about the defectiveness shame schema and explain that a little bit. And talk about what that might feel like. And interestingly, how we respond to it when we're triggered and how this can really differ for different people, because it's one of those schemas that you may never know that another person would have, and that it's very deeply hidden sometimes, right?
Deeply hidden, yeah.
So
very vulnerable.
So do you want to start with that, Justine? What do you think about the defectiveness schema? How do you define it to clients?
It's like it's just a deep sense of unworthiness. You're fundamentally flawed as a person and you feel quite unlovable. So we have unworthiness, unlovable, flawed.
Self-referential, and it's very, very internal. It's almost like it can be so ingrained and so part of the person, isn't it? So people will say things like, I'm just bad to the core, or there's something wrong with me, or I'm worthless. That's the voice of the defectiveness schema.
Yes.
And we sort of say those things. I suppose just for anybody who's new that's listening, when we talk about schemas, a definition or working definition might be, one way of describing them would be a deeply held emotion-laden core belief that we have, that we carry with us. We develop it early in life through not having our needs met. That schema is, so it's emotionally laden, very deeply held core belief that has strength of its own. And we go through life with this schema, and the schemas can be pretty robust. They tend to look for things that confirm the truth of that schema. We tend to do that. And that when our schemas are triggered, we can feel a whole host of things. Like, we can even feel them in our body. We can feel physical sensations. We can feel a flurry of the emotions that are connected with the schema, and thoughts
negative thoughts connected with the schema, memories. So it's not just a thought, it's more than that.
It's a whole mind-body experience.
Yeah,
a
whole mind-body.
Completely different state.
Yeah, so it hits you like you're kind of in a, it hits you like you're in a kind of different state.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can go from sort of being fairly neutral and then something happens, a trigger, an external or an internal trigger, and then the schema is activated. And then we can feel like all of, because negative thoughts love each other. So then we can have a flurry of all those sorts of thoughts about ourselves that confirm the schema. The defectiveness schema, like we said, is something that develops really early, and it's very much about yourself.
Mm.
Thoughts that go with it are, you know, I'm defective, I'm worthless, I'm not really any good at the core.
Yeah, because they operate outside your awareness, don't they? Like you don't even, like people don't come into therapy necessarily saying, I've got these old beliefs and I'm super aware of them and I know exactly how they trigger me. You have to kind of learn about them and learn to observe yourself in that way. They just feel so true, don't they, when they're triggered. It's like you don't question them. You just start sort of roll with them. If you've got a defectiveness schema, wow, that's and you're, you know, when you're triggered, you're then in this horrible shame bomb. I actually call it a shame bomb with my clients because that's actually the primary feeling, isn't it, with the defectiveness. You just feel awful and it feels like it's just so true. It feels so true that you are all that, you know, worthless, unlovable, who would want me?
And, yeah, no one would want me, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting shame, like the, as an emotion, if we just sort of, should we talk about that now just because that's the core emotional experience?
Yeah.
Shame is an emotion. People are always readily identify it, do they, as shame?
Yeah. Yeah.
That they're feeling.
And it's hard to identify sometimes.
Yeah. And you don't want to even.
You don't want to, you don't want to identify that.
No. It's like a weakness to even say that you're feeling shame. It's because it's such a vulnerable feeling. For a human being, you know, shame is sort of up there with anxiety, I reckon, in terms of how unpleasant it is and the extent we will go to avoid it. Because you think about shame, when you're shamed, you just want to hide, don't you? You just want to not be seen.
It's very much
away
that,
from the other, you know, whatever's going on.
And people will, like, people will see me, they'll see this flaw I've got, and so I don't want to expose that. I suppose, you know, when does shame develop as an emotion? Because it kind of develops in, I mean, just normally as a bit of an emotion in terms of it's very other, it's very how the other will see me.
That's right.
How I feel about myself.
Correct.
And it's
super young, pre-verbal, you know, because it's basically a survival emotion. Because human beings, we need to be with the group, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that threatens our relationship with others, so if someone's rejecting you, potentially back in the day when we were roaming the savannah with our family groups, we would have been in big trouble if we annoyed people so much that they ousted us out of the tribe. Mm-hmm. So it's very much about staying connected and prioritizing that of everything else.
Yeah. Okay. So it has a real evolutionary protective factor to be sort of accepted by the group.
Yes.
Otherwise you're shunned.
Shunned. And that's why it feels so bad. It's like it's a real visceral experience when you're shamed. I feel hot. It's like a sinking feeling. You might even sort of feel something going down your arms and legs. You can have a horrible pit in your stomach and you just don't want to make eye contact with anyone. You just want to kind of move away. Horrible feeling.
So how might it be triggered then? So we know that things that can happen internally, externally can trigger shame, someone criticizing us.
Oh, yes. It could be any sort of sense of disapproval, like real or imagined, basically, because you can have shame just imagining someone rejecting you or criticizing you or not choosing you or glaring at you or not looking at you. Or, you know what I mean? Like it can be any.
Just imagining giving that talk you've got to give
next
week
and
then thinking, it's not going to be well received and people will just think, why am I wasting my time listening to this person?
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's right. And that's enough to trigger your defectiveness schema or, you know, to have the big shame bomb response.
That's right. And because the thing we should mention, you know, is when schemas are laid down, when they're developed, because of the developmental phase, they're very concrete and they're very black and white. So they tend to be sort of all or nothing. Like, I'm not good. Who would want me? I'm worthless. There's just something wrong with me. Many clients will with this schema will say things like, I just feel there's something wrong with me.
It can be hard to get them to, because it's such a developed so early, being able to describe what that means in terms of their bodily sensations, what images they might have in their mind and the thoughts they're having, you know, like that can take a bit of time for them to become aware of all of that. Because reflexively, we just want to avoid the feeling. So they may not, people don't sit in shame very long before they've avoided it in some way.
And shame is very, so while we're on the subject of shame, it's a very kind of preoccupying and self-focused mainly type of emotion, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like, people see my flaws. It's kind of like a focus on the self. I'm no good, faulty, I'm worthless. It's how other people respond and then how that makes you feel rather than necessarily a focus outward. It tends to be more of an inward focused type of emotion and those perseverations, I suppose, about it. You know, people get hooked up on, you know, just negative thought after negative thought after negative thought about themselves.
Yeah, it can feed itself. You can stay in that state for very, you know, can become self-perpetuating. And it's, it's always triggered by some other, whether it's in front of you or it's imagined, but then you can become very much preoccupied with how, you know, worthless, hopeless, defective you are.
And it's about how I am in relation to the other.
Correct.
It's not particular, it's not concern about the other. It's about, oh my God, I'm bad. People will see me this way.
Yeah.
If I reveal my true self, they'll find out. They'll know I'm unlovable then.
Yes.
And so it's preoccupying in that kind of way.
Yes.
So there is an inherent self-absorption about shame. So that's why it overlaps with people who are, well, a lot of people who are quite narcissistic, that's one of their most preoccupying emotions, or they may not even be aware of that. They're just trying to never have that felt, I suppose.
Yeah, and that sort of segues a bit into the different ways of coping, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I think maybe before we talk about the different ways of coping, maybe we should talk a little bit more about where and how we get it. Where does it come from?
Early, from a caregiver, not being attuned enough, really. And that attunement can be quite badly misattuned, so being mistreated. No, so the more obvious criticism or being physically punished or having shouted at a lot or called names, yeah, obviously that's really the obvious one. So that's very shaming for a little person, very shaming. Yeah.
And so the obvious ones of like actual overt name calling or their psychological abuse, any form of it, any form of abuse where you're really mistreated, obviously. Yeah. So there's going to be that. And then there might be those, there might also neglect, also not being seen.
More subtle sort of misachievements. So even like a parent not looking and, you know, not paying enough attention to a child won't be thinking, oh, mum's just busy. She's got lots to do. They're going, oh, why isn't mum looking at me? I'm not good enough. Mm. I'm not good enough to have her stare into my eyes lovingly or pay me enough attention. I mean, and obviously you're not thinking that because you're not, but that's how it feels, because it's actually a rejection when a parent can't do that enough for a child. That's a very benign absence of something. It seems that actually they internalize it as there's something wrong with it because that's not happening.
And that sort of takes us just needs, doesn't it? Because we're born as humans, mammals, you know, into the world. We've got to have these core needs met emotionally. And one of them is to be seen and to be loved and cared for. And we don't have a felt sense of our lovability unless someone has loved us.
Oh, totally.
So our parents or our caretakers will in caring for us, communicate or not, that we are worthy of being taken care of being seen, being heard, noticed, you know, attuned to having my needs met. If you don't get that, and there's an inference that, okay, that must be because I'm lacking in some way, or I'm faulty, right? Maybe I am unlovable. That, like, and I suppose really early in life, like you said, we don't sit there with a sort of a cognitive way go through that. But certainly babies and young, very young children, we learn that we are lovable through getting our emotional needs met. So mum loves me or dad loves me. Ah, therefore I'm worthy. And because we don't come in, there's many ways of thinking about this, I suppose many different theories, but we don't come into the world knowing that. We get that through relational experiences.
Yeah.
So many of our clients haven't had that or adequately. And then you end up with the defectiveness schema. Because children are very self-referential, self-focused. And so if my needs are not getting met, we have a natural defense to assume we're at fault with that. I mean, we can't separate ourselves from our caregivers. We tend to own it and own the bad stuff that happens to us to some degree.
So it can be a tricky thing to work out sometimes why, particularly if it's more subtle. There's usually work backwards, don't you? If someone's displaying certain coping styles in the here and now, you work backwards, you think, okay, well, obviously they're protecting themselves from this feeling, which is not feeling good enough, the shame feeling. So you kind of know there's been some unmet needs, even though you may not necessarily remember the particulars of how you got there, because that's not always possible.
Of course, like all the schemas, it is on a continuum. So because defectiveness is not an uncommon schema. Like a fair amount of people would have some level of defectiveness, but they might have, you know, so it's like we talk about it like on a spectrum and a continuum like everything else. So you can have a little bit or you can have a lot, a preoccupying amount that really affects your relationships and how you are in the world, you know, who you choose to stay in relationships with and the decisions you make. Yeah. It's like every schema. If we have a lot of that schema, it's really going to affect our life course. Yeah, what kind of clients do you see? So think of like the schema or people that have a fair amount of the schema. And how would they normally present to you in therapy?
Well, two extremes come to mind. You've either got the person who is just so obvious it's in the room, it's not funny, like it's just colours their entire worldview. It's like they can't say a sentence without throwing some self-referential deprecating comment in there. I was never going to be good at that anyway. So, you know, like they tell you why they're there, but peppered throughout their story is that message of, yeah, I'm not worth it all, but of course he was never going to stay with me anyway, or I'm just no good at those things, or I never really gave it a go because I thought I probably wouldn't be good at it or I'd fail. Or, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just part of their intrinsic view of themselves. That can be super obvious from the beginning. Yeah. Have you?
It's so obvious. Yeah,
that's so obvious.
Where the schema, the meaning of the schema, they're really surrendering to the schema. So it feels that way and they'll say those things about themselves. Yeah, I mean, certainly I've had people like with chronic depression or recurrent depression, chronic, say things like, maybe I'm never going to get better because this is just who I am. Better person would have recovered by now. And so they even interweave the fact that they're depressed with
it's
that
a failing
belief about themselves. It's a failing, you know. So someone better would have overcome this, but no, of course, what can you expect? That kind of thing. So I see that a lot in people who are chronically depressed. Their defectiveness schema will jump out at you in some way.
Yeah. And I'm struck sometimes by, objectively speaking, they can look like they've actually done okay. So their self-report of how they feel about themselves isn't commensurate with actually their life and how they've lived their life, you know. So, yes, you know, they have children and married and their career may actually be okay. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's quite a mismatch. I think, oh,
yeah,
wow.
You're not looking at them thinking, oh, you're someone who's failed at everything you've tried and there's no obvious defects, but that's a schema.
Yes.
It's they feel that way. They might even feel the old imposter syndrome, I guess. That would be if you had a big imposter syndrome, you'd probably have a big defectiveness schema. Deep down, you think you're going to get found out. Yes, a lot of that goes on. A lot of that goes on. That seems to be really common. Sometimes I'm struck by the level of some people's defectiveness schema. So, like, often it will be just if I look at like my caseload over the years or something, okay, there'll be a lot of people who have a bit of it. Some people have, you know, a moderate amount. And then there'll be these people that have very, very, very big defectiveness schemas. And like you said, they're peppering it everywhere in their conversation. They're usually surrendering to it, but they'll reference it a lot. I just made a note here of like the two things I've seen. When I look back at those people and look back at their experiences, they do often have quite a background of a really quite a noxious parental influence, someone who actually is quite demeaning. mm-hmm. and or really severe abuse. So the message has been, you're nothing, you're worthless, who are you, kind of thing. And then you can hear that in their words. So that critic can be really quite demeaning and punitive.
Oh, the critic. Can you define that again in relation to defectiveness, actually?
Well, I suppose the critic would be one of the things that would be driving the defectiveness. If you've heard those messages, so I suppose there's the people who have heard obvious messages of defectiveness. Mm. And I don't think this is, thank God, hugely the norm, but people have been brought up where they've been called, you're useless, you are hopeless, you are worthless, who'd want you, look at you, all of that sort of stuff. Then we internalize that as kids. If we hear that, we internalize that. We internalize the messages from our parents. And then that feeds into how we see ourselves. Well, that's really fundamental, the foundations of our self-concept, our self-worth. And so the critic are those voices from the past, direct like that, or maybe inferences like, okay, I was overlooked, therefore the inference is I wasn't worth it. And so that's more subtle.
Yeah.
So either way, the people who have really big, strong, punitive critics, I usually see have a very big defectiveness schema. There's a correlation with sometimes hurting themselves or, just having this chronic or recurrent depressive episode that they get labelled in the mental health system as treatment-resistant depression. But really they've got a massive inner critic or other things that get in the way.
Like that idea that there's, that vulnerable part of you that feels horrible and hopeless, and then there's this part of you that induces it. So you kind of mimic what...
Yeah. And the critic has no, in schema therapy, because there's so many things going on in schema therapy in terms of modes.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that more probably in a future episode. But the critic, particularly this type of critic that drives people with a big defect in the schema, has no function. It's an old message from the past that is there to keep you down and to put you down and confirm negative experiences in your life. It's the voice of this type of critic says, well, what would you expect? You weren't going to succeed at that anyway. You've always been a failure. Come on, why aren't you good as such and such? Or don't even bother getting dressed up and putting on makeup because you're just ugly. And don't even bother studying for that test because I'm just going to fail anyway. And what hope would I have anyway because I'm just kind of never going to amount to anything. Yeah. That is the critic of a punitive kind of critic that when you have it, my experience is usually parents who have actually said those types of things and they've been said insidiously over the years by perhaps multiple people sometimes. And they've been reinforced, maybe by school with experiences or bullying or teachers.
Yeah, bullying.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. Yes.
Bullying.
Yeah, but usually you've already had those messages and that's why it's so you're vulnerable to those.
Yeah.
Re-experiencing those.
Exactly.
Kinds of situations.
And that's your template.
Yeah.
And so when you hear them later on, you just intuitively believe them.
It penetrates. It
matches that schema. And that's how schemas operate. We look, they're self-confirming. We want to find evidence to support our schemas because schemas are pretty robust. If we've got a lot of the schema, it can be really hard to change. And sometimes people hold on to the schema because that's the only thing they know about themselves. And change is scary.
Yeah, it's quite a sticky one, isn't it? This defectiveness schema can be, you have to really chip away at it, don't you?
It is a kind of a tricky one because it's linked to so many things, relationships, work, family. It's usually developed pretty early. And then we can get these, some of the other schemas that we develop out of the defectiveness schema, unrelenting standards. So there's things that we do to help improve ourselves. Actually, because I'm a bit of a stickler on the critic, so can I just clarify?
Totally.
The critic that I was talking about in schema therapy, that's called the punitive critic. But there are other types of critics.
Hello, Gemma Gladstone here. One thing that's always intrigued me about relationships and about partner selection is that we're often operating from a place of our default preferences, our default options, without ever really analysing or questioning why we're attracted to the people we're attracted to. So let me ask you a couple of questions.
Are you a woman who's currently dating or in a new relationship or reflecting on your relationship history? And do you have a pattern of getting involved with emotionally unavailable or narcissistic partners? And are you actually wanting to break this pattern once and for all so you can increase the likelihood of meeting someone who will actually be there for you? Well, the good news is we've created a course just for you. So just go ahead and click on the Red Flag Project at the show notes below to find out all about it. Now let's get back to the episode.
There are other types of critics. One might be functional, and that we might be able to befriend and modify. And that's the demanding critic. The demanding critic is pushing us to sort of like do better, but in a really harsh kind way, like, oh, like a fear, it's very fear driven. So the demanding critic is the fear driven critic that says things like, you know, if you don't study for that test, you won't pass this subject at uni, you won't get your degree, and you won't get the job you want. So that kind of motivating, but in a negative way.
Yeah.
It's not self-compassionate or anything, but it's a fear-based driven critic.
And it's too rigid.
And it's very rigid, you know, it's like black and white. Now that critic, be modified and even kind of like just to have get a mellower version of that critic. But the punitive critic, I think, and you think, and other people in schema therapy, there's no function to that critic. This is a nasty piece of work. Often, I just say with my caseload, when I come across a high, strong, punitive critic, there's often a big defectiveness schema, and there is somewhere a history of having heard those messages, or there's been abuse that has, you know, really horrible abuse back there, complex trauma type histories.
And I think it's like a real internalized contempt for yourself, isn't it?
It's totally
horrible. Have you heard people say, since we're at the function, that it protects them? So even though obviously it's horrible, it induces shame. So you know, you've always got these two things going on. You've got the part of you that's really vulnerable and feels horrible, and then you've got the part of you that tells you are, whatever those messages are.
Yeah.
So they're kind of going at the same time, or you're flipping in and out of them quickly when you're triggered. And then when you start really exploring in detail, helping people articulate what they actually sound like and how they feel, so they can start talking about them rather than just being a big mess of internal emotions and thoughts, that they are reluctant to let that one go, even though it sounds horrible.
Which one are they reluctant to? The punitive one?
The punitive one
is driving.
Well, the demanding one, yes. So that makes sense, because they worry if they let go of that one, that's why they're successful, or, you know, they'll fail.
Yeah.
But the punitive one, sometimes I've heard like it protects them from actually keeping them down, and them sort of abusing themselves in a way, prevents them from doing things that would actually cop that from someone in real life.
So it has that sort of
preemptively
protective sort of function.
Yes.
I think
which
that's
is sad.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point, because while we're on that topic, that might be picking up something else, because there are coping modes that might fall into that category. Would this be the type of thing you mean, that you're telling yourself how useless and hopeless you are? So what's the function of that with these people?
It's like it's a preemptive, well, that's just what I'm going to hear anyway from out there. So I'm doing it to myself. It feels better me doing it to myself and then not avoiding things, or, you know, assuming I'm bad rather than hearing it externally from someone.
Yeah, now that's an interesting function. And see that. So it's like nobody could think as bad about me as I think about
myself. Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So don't even start.
Yeah. So pretty much. And I'm going, wow, that when someone says that, oh my gosh, my urge is to go, you do not deserve to be spoken to that, even by yourself. But it's just so crippling. It's very, I can just see what you've heard. Yeah. Kind of what you were saying.
Would that fall into a category of like a coping mode?
Maybe.
There is this mode called which Susan Simpson talks a lot about, another schema therapist, you know, flagellating over controller. It feels a little bit like that, but it's not quite. Its function is to tell you how hopeless and worthless you are, and sometimes how guilty you are as a person, to strive on to just chronic self-improvement, because you're just so defective. So you've just got to, so it's a pushing, it's a function. Mm. It keeps the pain at bay. So you're never in touch with the real vulnerability underneath, but you're, so it's partly what you're saying, I think, perhaps. And It's partly, it's like a really insidious, over-controlling kind of self-improving mode.
Yeah, like a really critical pusher.
Really critical pusher. And yeah, so that's been differentiated as separate from the critic. But sometimes it's really hard to separate. It's all merged in, like what's a critical voice and what's a functional voice. It can be really tricky.
Yeah, people can
just flip. Yeah, if people can flip it, it's like, okay, well, I suppose getting the message, what is the critic or whoever or the mode or whatever saying to you, and can this be linked back to an old message, or is this something that has developed in you as a coping strategy? Mm-hmm. I suppose, so pulling it apart like that, if you're going to pull it apart.
Yeah.
But what about you? Have you, getting back to the defectiveness schema, people with big defectiveness schemas, what are their origins? Have you noticed patterns, like in terms of the development of the schema?
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of think of it, it's all varying degrees of misattunement. And kind of what I said, like on a continuum from really sort of abusive and then more sort of subtle kind of neglect or chronic dismissal by a parent. And I think that's why it's probably such a prevalent schema, because, well, A, it's really hard potentially in our busy modern life to always give your kids what they need in terms of time and attention, particularly if your kid's got a more sensitive temperament. But also, parenting practices are very shame-based, aren't they? Kind of yelling or, you know, smacking still quite prevalent. I saw a post actually by Justin Coulson, that's a child psychologist who's based here in Sydney. There was a survey done and 60% of parents in Australia still smack their kids.
Really?
Yeah.
Please don't smack your kids.
Yeah. I hope I'm not shaming too many of you as I say this, put it out in the podcast, but you know, and even though, look, I was smacked as a kid. Were you smacked?
Right, I was.
Yes. 1970s, 1980s parenting, totally normal. But increasingly, as we've looked at what that actually does to your child's sense of self and their relationship with you, there are other ways to manage your child's defiance or misbehavior or whatever it is that you're struggling with. Because really, if you're smacking your child, you're just feeling powerless. You know, it's sort of usually you don't go into it doing that generally. It's usually after a bit of, you don't know what else to do, you just want to get them to stop doing it. But when you smack your child, you make them scared of you. It's such a powerful rejection. It's so shaming. Yeah. And your child may not show that shame to you. They may look hardened and angry back. Mm-hmm. But I can, you know, just to say it straight, that is exactly what they're feeling. You just can't get away from it. That's just what happens. So all of that, that's what gives rise to the sense of defectiveness. And, you know, every situation is different. There's lots of things in the mix, but it always comes from some misattunement.
I mean, we could probably talk about parenting practices and things like smacking for hours.
I know. Because
it's so it's so loaded, but it's so just, it makes me really sad.
Yeah, it is. It's very sad.
If I was upset with something you did, Justine, I just wouldn't hit you.
Wouldn't hit me?
Or I don't hit my husband. Why the hell would you hit your child?
It's interesting because it's not to say, like, you, depending on how you were treated, like, that tends to be our urge generally as parents, generally speaking. We don't tend to question too much whether what we had, in most cases, whether it was bad or not. We just kind of do what we experience by and large, unless we do some self-examination. So, parenting can be very shaming, even parents who love their children very much. And shaming your child or shame as an emotion is still a very normal emotion. So not all shame is bad, is it? You know, like you want to be able to. Shame is about basically having good relationships, really. It's staying attached to someone, doing the right thing by people. Yeah. So, you know, if you make a mistake and it violates your values, you can think, oh, my gosh, I was not a good person in that situation. It's not all bad. So you can, shame is still involved in parenting, I suppose is what I'm saying. But differentiating normal shame from toxic shame.
So a child is going to feel shame if you would say, you know, like if they told you about something that happened in the playground and they said that they're involved in doing something where a child was felt bad. And you said, hey, like, let's not speak to people like that, that kind of thing. They're going to feel like, oh, I've done something wrong, a bit of shame, but that's okay. That's not like, but toxic shame would be to say things that really attack the person's worth and that core sense of, am I okay? Things that compromise that, such as like, what is wrong with you? Why are you thinking or feeling that?
Why would you say that?
And the big one, like your sister never does this or your brother never does this. And one child is compared unfavorably against the other. Or every other kid in your class can read, surely. What's wrong with you? Or, you know, those sort of things where you're really giving them that message that there's something wrong with you in there. You're not okay. You're not okay. You hear that all the time. And it's so easy for a little word, like letter sentence like, oh, God, what's wrong with you, to pop out of your mouth. It's easy.
That's a yes.
I mean, how many parents would say that, you know, and I'm sure I've said that or felt like saying that, but you kind of got to go, oh, okay, like that's actually, the child's going to hear that and then internalize it. If they hear that insidiously every day, you're going to have a defectiveness schema.
Yeah, that's just what happens.
You know, whether you hit or not or whatever, or any other kind of abuse. It's that inference, there's something wrong with me, what is wrong, I've got some problem. Mum loves spending time with my brother, but she doesn't like spending that time with me, that, you know, that kind of thing. That shame that is more toxic than a lot of people who are narcissistic, because they're overcompensating to their defectiveness schema, have. That shame is very deep, that runs really deep, and it's really like, what's wrong with me? But we're kind of like, went off on an interesting tangent about the parenting, but maybe we should talk a little bit about coping styles because it's so important.
Yeah, to be able to work out how you're coping with your shame.
So the examples that we were talking about clinically a little while ago when we started talking, we were giving examples of clients who really surrender to their defectiveness schema. Mm. So in the therapy room, you can see it. It's straight up. I'm worthless. I'm hopeless. This would happen, of course. What would I expect? So they're people who are feeling the defectiveness, or they've got a trigger and they're actually fully in touch and fully engaged with the quality of that schema. And they're believing that schema, the feeling of it, and they're believing that schema to be true. Yep, I am worthless. No wonder I've got a partner who yells and screams at me or who hits me, because I don't deserve anybody better. That's a surrendering statement. So it's easy to spot that. Those people are in touch with their vulnerability. They're in touch with their defectiveness. They're living it every day. They're the surrendering, the surrenderers. And so that's only one style of coping with your defectiveness schema. Another one that causes lots of problems is when we overcompensate, or in the Reinventing Your Life, the word is counterattack. When we get a whiff of the schema and then we fight against the schema. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, we shut it down as quickly as possible, perhaps to the detriment of our relationships. So this is people, as you said, who are more entitled or narcissistic. Narcissism is a shame problem, a defectiveness problem, really, with a cluster of really unhelpful coping styles or modes attached to it, so the person doesn't feel the pain of that shame and rejection. So if someone's entitled, they're overcompensating or they're counterattacking and they look superior, and they may sort of be very critical of other people. They may be very defensive, so not really able to hear what you're saying, particularly if it's about them. They can be very, another way of overcompensating, being very grandiose and sort of talking extremely positively about yourself and your achievements all the time. Yeah, can you think of any others? Mm. Those are the ones that...
And sometimes you can, that's big, like the grandiose, but you see a lot in with people who are very, very critical. And so by criticizing others, you can deflect any negative feeling and putting it on them. They're criticizing your kids, it's another one. You know, that kind of thing. Or the book talks about scapegoating. You know, the people that are always the parent who scapegoats the child and focuses on the child as the problem child in order to stop them coming, you know, feeling their own defectiveness. They're pointing out the flaws in other people, or just saying other people have flaws. But that phrase, little people belittle people. If you're feeling good about yourself, if you deep down have a very strong defectiveness schema and you're very shame, you've got a lot of shame around it and everything like that, you're going to feel shit about yourself. And the way to feel better is to get lots and lots of evidence for that, and so that you actively try to create that. So you'll put people down, because in doing so, you can kid yourself that you're better than them.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So you can criticize others and think, oh, I wouldn't do it like that. You're doing it like that. So you're sort of pointing out other people's flaws. So at least you don't have to look at yourself, but it also kind of makes you feel better about yourself.
It's like, I think I just mentioned another, like the shame exchange. Mm-hmm. It's like you don't want to feel your own shame, so you induce it in others and elevate yourself, basically, in a situation. Right. So, if you're looking down being an expert on someone's decisions or whatever, you're feeling superior, but obviously, potentially, you're shaming them. Mm. You don't care about that in that moment. You're just, that's why it's a very self-focused feeling, isn't it? You just want to get rid of it. Is it so unpleasant?
That what you just said there is often how a lot of defectiveness schemas develop in children.
Yes.
Because if you've been raised by a narcissist or someone who is doing that overcompensating or counterattacking, then like that's great, that shame exchange phrase, because that's exactly what's happening. You know, I'll give you my shame. The child feels it because they do. They're like sponges and they soak up all the psychological energy and the messages. They feel shame and defective, and you can feel okay because you're constantly batting it out of your field of reference. And so the overcompensator is, we've all come across them. They're difficult to be with because they're either telling you how good they are or exaggerating their successes or boasting about their successes or putting you down or being critical, being superior in that kind of way. It's like the classic inferiority, superiority, the old complex. Yeah. Mm.
It's not pretty. And obviously, it's not pretty. That's on a continuum as well.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's a relationship killer.
It is. It's hard. Work.
Should we just like make a comment about, you know, we've been talking about schema chemistry for a while now in relationships, and can you think of any clients you've seen where the defectiveness schema has been really pronounced and how that's played into schema chemistry?
Or even just that whole someone with a, so both parties have defectiveness. Mm. So both have a strong defectiveness schema. One surrenders, one overcompensates. Perfect. Yeah. Match made in
heaven. Perfect fit.
The shame exchange is like, so the surrenderer is used to thinking they're worthless and unworthy, etc., and that they're kind of uncomfortably sitting in that feeling a lot and they don't fight against it. And so then when their partner, if their partner's more of an overcompensator, they're quite familiar with having the shame offloaded onto them and being the problem. Mm. And the overcompensator can stay out of touch of their shame because they're managing to offload it to the other person and not be, and that's a unfortunately a common dynamic.
It is, and they might, of course, have lots of other schemas going on too.
Yes.
But, you know, the person who's surrendering to their defectiveness schema, essentially it matches their view about themselves to have this person criticising them.
Yeah.
You didn't clean the house properly. You missed that kind of spot, or, God, you can't even chop a vegetable properly, you know, like,
I know,
micromanager, kind of overcompensator, sort of thing, constantly critical, nitpicking.
Yeah, so the surrender has got obviously their own internal critic going, and then they've got an external one that mimics the internal one. So
it's a match. And so when people say, like, why don't you leave? And they'll probably say something like, well, because, you know, it's just, it's not that bad, or who else am I going to find? That's a tough one. But I think if you're someone with a strong defectiveness schema, the good news is that it can be modified.
Definitely.
Sometimes it's about getting creative with looking at what's maintaining the schema for you. Are you in a schema-driven relationship that is maintaining your sense of defectiveness, for example? Is your partner highly critical, who's scapegoating you, who's criticizing you, your every move? How is that for you? Like, is that reinforcing your schema and keeping you depressed?
Yeah.
Or the job you're in?
Yeah, sort of really becoming aware of that part of you that's basically mean to yourself, you know, the part of you that whatever form that takes, however extreme, just really beginning to notice how you talk to yourself when you make mistakes, or how you talk to yourself about your weaknesses. Are you allowed, do you allow yourself to have any strengths, or do you quickly shut any thoughts about those down? Yeah, just really beginning to observe that part that shames you internally.
Yeah, trying to externalize the part that shames you and to say, maybe write it down, you know, what are these shaming thoughts? Because they're usually so automatic. So you might spill something on the counter, or you spill your coffee or something like that, and instantly you're saying something really negative and nasty to yourself. And it's so automatic, you don't even notice you're doing it.
Yeah.
You might, you know, some people who have a strong schema don't even notice that they're actually being so incredibly unkind to themselves. And that's when you, if you introduce something like, oh, how about an alternative compassionate voice? It's so foreign. It's a foreign concept. But yeah, start to think about and externalize these messages and stories in your head and realize it's just a story. It was a story that was built up over years that was written for you. You can rewrite it.
I say to clients, you were not born with that voice. No. It was given to you.
Exactly. And sometimes it's easy to identify, like when you say to someone, like, who's that? They'll say, yeah, this is my dad.
Yes.
This is what he said, blah, blah, blah. And other times it's harder to figure it out. It may be more based on inferences. I didn't get that mean, Matt. I didn't get that mean. Therefore, I am unlovable. So it can be either direct. The voice in your head might be direct coming from a certain parent, or it might be a conglomeration of experiences that you've had, or like we sort of touched on very briefly, it might even be a way of coping with the feeling of defectiveness. Yeah, it's kind of a big issue, that one.
That is.
A really common schema. Would you say anything else about that's hopeful about this? That's hopeful about this schema, or how would people?
Hopeful, yeah. Well, just that, as with all of these things, once you can get a nice snowball effect. So just as you probably experience a snowball effect in a negative direction, like once you start thinking negatively and being self-critical, it just sort of becomes all about that. Once you've worked out actually what your self-compassionate, healthy adult voice sounds like, you can get a positive spiral in the other direction. So it becomes much easier to be dismissive of that critical voice and to be more supportive towards yourself when you make mistakes, and to be more supportive of yourself being authentic without prioritizing, avoiding criticism, you know, even though at the beginning it may seem very clunky because you may not actually have the words yet.
Yeah, totally. And one thing I would say about the way we cope with, well, the role of the critic, but also the way we cope with our schemas, say, if you're an overcompensator, so you're always kind of looking for faults in other people, that kind of thing. There's no way you're going to be able to heal your defectiveness schema if you keep doing that, right? Because in order to heal something, we've got to feel it. So if you're never in touch with the pain of it, you're never going to have the opportunity to let your vulnerable part feel that and for you to respond to that in a healthy way. In therapy, we know two of the biggest blockers are like the overcompensating modes or coping modes, and also the critical voice inside the head. So the first port of call is to say, what are we doing that's maintaining the schema? Have I got a part of me that is encouraging the schema to exist? And have I got a part of me that's feeding me these kind of messages? We want those things to get out of the way, so that you can actually feel the pain of it, so that you can start to heal it. Because unfortunately, we usually have to feel those emotions somewhere there in the mix.
Making friends with your shame, being okay with that feeling bit in your body, even though you don't like it. I think, you know, just emotional tolerance, really important. You can get there.
To start.
Okay.
Well, we'll probably leave it there on defectiveness, but you might have a question about that schema that you want to email us. So feel free to do that at justineandgemma@goodmood.com.au. Or if you have any other comments or topics that you'd like us to spend some time on,
let us know.
Let us know. We will be keeping you up to date with other things, but the link to our course, The Red Flag Project, and the Schema Chemistry webinar will be, as usual, in the show notes. So have a look at those if they relate to you.
Great.
And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Hi, before you go, I just want to tell you about a new offering that we have. It's a 2-hour recorded schema chemistry webinar. This is for you if you've ever wondered why you have super high chemistry with people who turn out to be just absolutely no good for you, or perhaps you've struggled with finding those people who are emotionally available attractive, or maybe you've got in your head that you're only attracted to a certain type, and you couldn't possibly be attracted to that person unless they were your type. Well, all this has to do with schema chemistry. And schema chemistry is the attraction that you feel to partners who have the potential to really trigger your schemas. Or another way of saying this is that they have the potential to emotionally wound you in the same way that your primary attachment figures did. So Justine and I have developed this webinar, and in the webinar, we go through schema chemistry in a whole lot of depth. It's 2 hours, but we really get into the nitty gritty here. We tell you
where it's from, how it develops, the origins of it historically, and we go into what it feels like. We go into common case examples so you can identify yourself and your own patterns in the webinar. And then we start to tell you how you can really unpick it and how you can start to challenge schema chemistry. Because, I mean, we've all had those kinds of relationships where the sexual chemistry is super high, but really, like when it comes to emotional needs, you get zero met, right? This is all to do with schema chemistry. We've all had those relationships where there's high chemistry at the beginning, but sadly, they just crash and burn and then we're devastated. Well, we're going to tell you all about it in this webinar. Don't miss it. It's the Schema Chemistry webinar. Just click on the link in the show notes.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to share it with others. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get notifications when new shows are released. You can visit us at goodmood.com.au/podcast for more information. You know, this podcast is intended for learning and entertainment purposes, and we really hope it achieves that. But because it's not a substitute for personal therapy, we'd like you to consult a qualified mental health professional for tailored support. Bye for now.